United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The United States Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit is now open according to law. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Thank you, Ms. Tisa, and good morning to counsel. this is Beverly Martin, and we appreciate you adapting to this new format of oral argument. I know I speak for Judge Newsom. We would much prefer to be with you live and in person in Miami, but this is the way we've been doing this now for several months, and we think it works pretty well. With regard to the timing, I've asked Ms. Tisa to give you notice of the two-minute warning when you're two minutes away from the end of your time, as well as to call time. And because of the kind of lag with the telephone, she says it twice, so you'll hear that and understand what she said. And I believe in our instruction fee, we have told you that we would give you the first of your argument uninterrupted. My goodness, since he's not sitting here where I can see him, I've neglected to welcome Judge Baldock. Judge Baldock is a friend of the court. He is, of course, a judge on the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. He has assisted the 11th Circuit for quite some time with our work, and he's a dear friend and a wonderful colleague. So Judge Newsom and I especially wanted to welcome you, Judge Baldock, and thank you for getting up so early.
Thank you.
All right. With that, I'll call the case of Carl Hoffer versus the Secretary of the Florida Department of Corrections.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. James Percival for the Florida Department of Corrections. The district court erred in denying summary judgment for the secretary and in granting it for the plaintiff on whether the secretary's treatment plan for F-0s and F-1s is constitutionally adequate. The district court also failed to make the necessary PLRA findings. On the Eighth Amendment issue, there are three points I want to cover today. One, that the secretary reasonably followed the recommendations of his learned expert, Dr. Dusnip. Second, that at worst, Dr. Kaziel's testimony shows reasonable medical disagreement. And three, that states are permitted to consider cost as one of many factors in selecting appropriate medical treatment. So I really want to start by talking a little bit about the hepatitis C virus and the secretary's treatment plan. And the way I like to think about this is you kind of divide it into four categories. So you have what we call spontaneous clearance, which is where the virus clears from the body, and there are really no disputes about those individuals. The second is what we call stable chronic infection, which is where you have no progression at all. The third is slow progression, and the fourth is rapid progression. Now, in talking about the treatment plan, I want to start with rapid progression because I want to clear up maybe some misconceptions or some things that there were disagreements about in the briefing. What I want to emphasize is that even if you are an F0 or an F1, you are treated with DAAs, and you don't have to wait till the F2 level if you either show signs of or are at risk for rapid progression. And when I say show signs of, what I mean is we monitor these individuals, and if they go from F0 to F1 within 4 years, they're eligible for treatment. And when I say at risk of, what I mean is that rapid progression is not something that sort of happens at random. There are a variety of risk factors associated with that, HIV, hepatitis B, things like that. And individuals that have those, what we call exacerbating illnesses, they're eligible for DAA treatment. They don't have to wait until the F2 level. So I say that so that I think we can focus on where the real dispute is in this case, which I think is about the stable chronic infection group and the slow progression group. And Dr. Dusnip's opinion is that with the stable chronic infection group, the slow progression group, that it is medically appropriate to monitor these individuals and to watch them, to continue to test them for exacerbating illnesses, and otherwise to wait to treat them with DAAs until the F2 level.
Mr. Percival, this is Beverly Martin. I just wanted to press you just a little bit on that. In his deposition testimony, or it was in the trial, I guess, Dr. Doosnup said that he liked, and I gather subscribed to, the guidelines set by the American Association for Study of Liver Disease and the Infectious Disease Society of America, which calls for treatment of all patients with chronic hepatitis. So that's a little bit in conflict with what you're saying his testimony was. I mean, he says, you know, ultimately you're going to treat people with F0 and F1, but, you know, I understand as a matter of course you don't treat them unless you put them in the rapid progression category.
That's a really good question, Your Honor, and I think the answer to that question is found in Dr. Doosnup's testimony. This is at docket entry 340-19 at page 60. And what he basically says is, you know, there's all this discussion in our brief about these studies and how Dr. Doosnup doesn't think that these studies establish that DAAs cause these improved outcomes. And what he says on page 60 is, he says, what the guidelines do is they say, you know, we don't know the cause. There's some uncertainty here, but out of an abundance of caution, we recommend treatment. And Dr. Doosnup says, you know, that strikes him as a reasonable approach. And if, you know, if he had unlimited resources, unlimited capacity, that maybe you would do that. You know, I think there's a point in his testimony where he says if these drugs were the cost of aspirin, we wouldn't have to do prioritization. But our position is, under the Eighth Amendment, which, you know, sets the floor, it was permissible for him to look closely at the scientific literature to determine, you know, to sort of balance the benefits and the costs. And so, you know, his view is that the guidelines are sort of helpful, and they say, you know, in the best possible world, this is something we might do. But his view is that it's not, you know, strictly necessary.
So that's really, I guess, the point of my question. I mean, so what other facts are there in this record that support not treating F0 and F1 patients other than how much it costs? Is cost the one thing that inhibits your treatment of those people, or are there other facts that cause you not to treat them?
I mean, I think, you know, in our brief, we talk about kind of the resources involved, you know, the sort of front-end staging and the back-end stuff. But I think the biggest thing is it's not just cost. It's also an opinion about medical necessity. And he testified in his deposition at 110 and 129, in his testimony at 154, that he just didn't think there was, you know, scientific data, studies establishing that there was a medical necessity here. And we think, you know, because plaintiffs bear the burden, and he really showed why the studies that they're relying on don't satisfy that burden. And we don't think that the plaintiffs provided a meaningful response to that. Two other points, Your Honor. One is, I think,
Mr. Percival, but the state conceded that chronic hepatitis C requires treatment, right?
We conceded that it's a serious medical need. What I think the important point is, F0 and F1 has to be a serious medical need. And the reason is because you need to monitor F0s and F1s to determine if they have rapid progression or they have an exacerbating illness. And if we said it wasn't a serious medical need, that would mean that we wouldn't have to do anything. But what we did
Counsel, this is Judge Baldock. I need to ask a question in reference to the discussion that you and Judge Martin are having. What is the difference in treatment between F0, F1, and F4? Is it the same treatment?
The same drug?
Yes. I mean, yes, the trial court's ordered that you must treat from FO, F0, whatever you want to call it, F1. My question is, what's the difference in treatment?
there's no difference in terms of what drugs are provided. I think, if I understand Your Honor's question, the question is when you provide the treatment. So our position is you can wait until somebody reaches the F2 level. Does that answer Your Honor's question?
No, because I don't think the court ordered that. He ordered that you treat F0 and F1 the same time that you would treat F4. Isn't that correct?
What you're saying is he basically ordered treatment across the board regardless of whether you're in F0 and F1.
That's yes. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And this is Judge Newsom. Just to follow up, I guess my understanding is that that's basically the subject of the appeal. The district court's order requires you to treat F0s and F1s just like you do F4, and you think that the Eighth Amendment doesn't require that and that it allows you to delay treatment for 0s and 1s until they show rapid progression or some other underlying condition.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor.
Got it.
Okay, then let me ask you this question then. What is precisely the standard of medical care for a prisoner under the Eighth Amendment? Is it the best available care? Is it the minimal adequate care? Exactly what is the standard that the trial court was obligated to follow in this matter?
So it's minimally adequate care, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And I think, just following up on that, there's a really interesting line in Dr. Kaziel's testimony where she's asked a question about what she does if somebody doesn't have insurance. And what she basically says is, you know, the best possible care is to treat people early, and that's what I like to do. But if I have somebody who's not insured, I put them at ease. I tell them, you know, I will watch you, I'll keep an eye on you, and I'll make sure that you don't suffer substantial harm. And our view is that discussion, that's an application of something much closer to the Eighth Amendment standard than her discussion earlier, where she's sort of saying what she thinks is the best possible care. I do want to go back to Dr. Dusnip's testimony and talk a little bit more about why we think this record shows reasonable medical disagreement as a matter of law. And I think one of the really important things to emphasize is if you look at the preliminary injunction record, what happened was...
Two minutes, counsel.
Oh, yeah, so Dr. Kaziel raised a number of criticisms of Dr. Dusnip's treatment plan. She raised criticisms about monitoring. She raised criticisms about rapid progression. And what Dr. Dusnip said is he said, you know, these are really interesting and in many ways valid criticisms. I'm going to go back to the drawing board, and I'm going to make some changes to the treatment plan. On F0s and F1s, though, he very much held his ground. And he said, you know, I hear what Dr. Kaziel is saying, but he provided a very reasoned point-by-point explanation for why he didn't think he needed to make changes to the treatment plan based on the criticisms that had been raised. And I really think, you know, other than what we cited in our brief, the principal thing, I would also look at the cross-examination of Dr. Dusnip, which is at page 154 of his testimony. I think he really clarifies this.
And I'll just ask you to... I'm not sure I heard the answer to my question. What is a reason other than cost for not treating an F0, F1 hepatitis C patient?
Yeah, I think the answer, Your Honor, is a judgment about medical necessity. So our position is that you can basically do a cost-benefit analysis, just like a person would do, you know, if they were paying for their own treatment outside of prison. You could say, what are the risks? How much does it cost? And you can balance those two things. And so, you know, if we were denying treatment solely based on cost, we wouldn't be treating the F2s and other individuals. But where we've determined that it's medically necessary, we are treating. And where we've determined that it's not medically necessary and that the costs don't justify the treatment, then we're not treating. Does that answer Your Honor's question?
Well, where is that in the record? I mean, did you put on proof about that? How many F0 patients are you treating, for example? Is there any record about that?
I think there is. I don't have the citation for that at my fingertips. What I will say is that Dr. Dusnip said in his expert report his first expert report that's in our appendix, he said treatment must not be prohibited solely based on cost. So he explicitly said in developing his treatment recommendation that he was applying the principle that you cannot deny treatment based solely on cost, that you have to account for medical necessity. And then his multiple expert reports, his testimony, and his deposition contain, I think, very detailed articulations of why the treatment was not medically necessary under the circumstances of the treatment plan.
But it's your idea that that number is in the record somewhere. How many F0 patients you're treating?
I think it is, Your Honor. I mean, the truth is.
Sorry.
Answer my. You think it is in the record? Is that?
It's a constantly moving number, Your Honor, because of testing and new prisoners coming in and staging happening over time. So I'm sure there are numbers in the record because things were kind of constantly being updated. They're probably not current, and I don't know exactly what they are. I apologize.
Okay, thank you.
Can I ask just, Judge Martin, do you mind if I ask just one follow-up question?
No, of course not.
The conversation that you're having now. So about the state of the record, I just want to make sure that I've got this straight in my head. So whose burden is it? Is it your burden to show that it is not necessary to treat the zeros and ones, or the plaintiff's burden to show that it is medically necessary to treat the zeros and the ones?
It's the plaintiff's burden, Your Honor.
Okay.
And that's, I know I'm out of time, Your Honor. I have a little bit more of a detailed answer, but I'll leave it to Judge Martin's discretion whether she wants me to elaborate.
No, I want you to answer it.
Okay. I think part of the issue with the district court's analysis is that the district court, in our view, sort of leapfrogged the question of medical necessity, and not just medical necessity, but the fact that we had articulated at a minimum reasonable medical disagreement about necessity, and the court jumped straight to the subjective rationale of the department. Now, as I explained to Judge Martin, we dispute the district court's conclusion about the subjective rationale.
I'm not hearing you talk about burdens, and I thought that was the question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. So I was trying to explain why we think that they have the burden and that the way the district court did the analysis kind of leapfrogged that threshold step. But
I think we've got that.
I apologize, Ron.
Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Dante Trevisani, and I represent the plaintiffs, appellees Ronald McPherson, Roland Molina, and Carl Hoffer, who died during the pendency of this case, and the class that was certified in the district court. The district court below entered a targeted injunction requiring treatment for individuals at the F0 and F1 fibrosis levels within 2 years of diagnosis, an injunction that was supported by undisputed evidence of the harm faced by these individuals. The court's order granting plaintiff's motion for summary judgment should be affirmed for three reasons. First, the district court correctly held that the secretary's refusal to provide treatment only for financial reasons, while recognizing that such treatment was medically necessary, amounted to deliberate indifference to serious medical needs. That conclusion alone should resolve the Eighth Amendment issue in our favor. Second, if the court reaches the second Eighth Amendment issue, it should hold that the district court also correctly granted summary judgment by finding that it was undisputed that individuals at F0 and F1 face a substantial risk of serious harm. This was for several reasons, chief among them being that the secretary conceded that it was inappropriate to treat only those with advanced fibrosis, and that immediate treatment for all fibrosis levels was required by the medical standard of care. The third and final issue is whether the district court's order complies with the Prison Litigation Reform Act. It does. The order provides a detailed description of how it meets the statute's requirements, even though it did not repeat that analysis under separate subheadings corresponding to each statutory prong. With respect to the first issue, the district court properly held that the secretary's decision to refuse to provide treatment to those at F0 and F1 based only on costs, while conceding that it was inappropriate to withhold treatment from those at lower fibrosis levels, was deliberate indifference. The district court did not hold, as the secretary claims, that any consideration of cost is barred by the Eighth Amendment. The district court rather held that withholding treatment only because of costs was deliberate indifference.
Can I ask you a quick question? This is Judge Newsom. It's hard for me to get my head around exactly sort of how the considerations of need and cost do and should inform Eighth Amendment questions. I recognize that in Harris, we said or suggested, I guess technically in dicta, but in any event, suggested that cost couldn't be a reason for refusing the constitutional minimum. But in the same opinion, of course, we also said that the Eighth Amendment doesn't require medical care that is great or even very good. So it dawns on me that surely the reason that we've said that cost can't be an exclusive reason, a sufficient reason for denying minimum medical care is because the minimum of medical care is so low. Don't you see that connection? I mean, certainly in the private world, there are lots and lots and lots of people who, you know, can't get the medical treatment that they need solely because it's too expensive. I've got a friend who takes IVIG infusions, and they're about $8,000 a pop. And if the insurance doesn't come through, then she just can't get them. She needs them, but she just can't get them. And then cost is the sole reason. So why would the result be any different inside a prison?
Well, Your Honor, I think in this case that this court has said in other opinions that deliberate indifference to serious medical need can be shown by knowing that medical care is required and refusing to provide it, or by delaying treatment for non-medical reasons. So
But just so we're clear, I mean, you are saying that no matter how expensive the treatment, what you're saying is that a prisoner is entitled to better medical treatment than you would be on the outside. I mean, do you think that F0s and F1s have to wrangle with an insurance company before they get the DAA treatment, or do you think the insurance company just says, oh, sure, you're an F0, get it?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, all insurance companies, as far as the record I believe reflects, are providing DAA treatment at F0 and F1. The Medicaid system is providing DAA treatment at F0 and F1, and so is the Veterans Affairs system.
Do you have to justify that, or does it come as a matter of course?
Well, I don't believe the record is that specific. I mean, we can point to some evidence that are a docket entry 11-1 and 35-2, which are the announcements of the Florida Medicaid system and the VA system that we're going to provide those DAA treatment for people immediately. And I think that the thing that distinguishes the issue that Your Honor has brought up from this case is the fact that there's a concession in the record that treatment is medically necessary. And so we're not saying that costs can never be taken into account. And in fact, the district court did take costs into account. And despite the fact that immediate treatment is the standard of care, it didn't order immediate treatment for everyone, specifically to account for the prison's logistical and financial needs.
When you say immediate treatment, you mean treatment of some kind or treatment with DAA specifically? I mean, another hypothetical, I suppose, a prisoner who's going deaf, is that prisoner immediately entitled to cochlear implants when a hearing aid would be cheaper?
Well, I think that prisoner would be entitled to what a doctor has recommended that prisoner needs under those circumstances, and that the prison would have to provide it absent some compelling reason otherwise. And I think that's an important point here, is we're not saying that costs can't be taken into account. They just can't be taken into account to the exclusion of any medical judgment. And I think that's what the record shows happened here, which is that...
So let me ask you this just on my hypothetical. So... prisoner going deaf, you've got one doctor who says, wow, we need cochlear implants stat immediately. And you've got another doctor who says, well, I think a hearing aid will do for now, but if the deafening worsens, proceeds to the next stage, then perhaps we could consider cochlear implants at that point. You're saying, I think, that would be deliberately indifferent.
Well, I think that would depend on a couple of things. If the doctor or the official is saying that the person has to wait because it's too expensive, then I think we get into a closer issue. But I think that your hypothetical, I think, illustrates exactly why this case is different. Because what you pose, Your Honor, is a reasonable disagreement between two forms of treatment. Whereas here, this isn't a dispute between two forms of treatment where one just happens to be less expensive. It's a choice between the only form of treatment that's available and no treatment at all, where the only reason for not providing that treatment is financial. So, again, we have an interesting and sort of unique case here where there is only one form of treatment.
Let me just follow up, and then I promise I'll let you go. But this is helpful to me. It really is. So let's just extend the hypothetical a little bit so that you've got a prisoner in the very early stages of hearing loss, and instead of there being two choices, there are three choices. The first choice is, you're just going to have to deal with a little bit of hearing loss. But if it starts to get worse rapidly, then we'll think about hearing aids. And if it really hits the fan, we'll talk about cochlear implants. So between steps one and two, where that's essentially no treatment, it's just monitoring, that's deliberately indifferent?
I think if that treatment were made for only medical reasons and there were only the only form of treatment available was the cochlear implant, then yes, that would be the answer. Because again,
what would the medical reason be for saying, I'm sorry, but for right now, you're just going to have to deal with, sort of 25% hearing loss?
Well, I don't know. I think it would be that we'd have to look at what testimony was elicited in that case. What are the doctors saying? What are the experts saying with respect to how this is treated? Does the standard of care allow for different types of treatment? Whereas here, we only have one form of treatment. There is only one way to treat hepatitis C. And then the other important point there, Your Honor, I think is that it would have to depend on whether that hearing loss qualified as a serious medical need. Whereas here we have a concession from the Department of Corrections that hepatitis C at all fibrosis levels, including F0 and F1, qualifies as a serious medical need. So I think that shows that the Secretary knows that treatment is required, and the Secretary has not made a reasoned medical judgment. The Secretary has simply said that we don't want to pay for the drugs because we don't want to pay for the drugs. And I think that leads into another important point that was raised in the first part of the argument about the costs. I think it's important to note that the Secretary hasn't argued, as far as I understand it, that they cannot afford to provide this treatment. They're just saying that they don't want to pay for it. And if this became an important issue in this case, the only record evidence about the cost of the drugs now comes from October of 2017, when that testimony came in, which is almost 3 years ago. And then we have a deposition in June of 2018 where we heard the department was getting an aggressive discount on the price, but we don't actually know the cost. So my point being is that if the Secretary is making an argument that they can't afford it, there's really no evidence in the record from which we could be able to make that conclusion.
This is Judge Baldock, and I need to ask a question real quick here, because it goes back to the burden, and I believe that the burden is yours. And is the record going to show me that Dr. Cosell, I guess it is, that she testified that she really got started to get agitated and concerned about irreparable complications when Hep C patients reaches the F3 level and has not been treated with the DAAs? Now, if that's correct, how does that establish then an irreparable injury to those class members at FO and F1? Now, is the record going to show me that that's what she said?
Your Honor, that's not quite correct in terms of what she said. Her unequivocal recommendation was that everybody at all levels of fibrosis stage should receive DAA treatment, even at F0 and F1.
And it's the same treatment.
That's correct.
If there's a difference between FO and F1 of any difference in the treatment, and that there's no concern really that medically gets her really uptight is at F3, then where is the irreparable injury at F0 and F1?
Well, her testimony, Your Honor, about when she really gets agitated was in response to a specific hypothetical that she was given in terms of what would happen if a patient came in without insurance. And what she said was that she would immediately advocate to get that person treatment. But if treatment wasn't forthcoming, that she would get really agitated once the person got to F3. But she never said that it was appropriate to wait to F3, and she never said that treatment was not required at F0 and F1.
Counsel, my question is as to irreparable injury. In other words, that's your burden, as far as I understand in this matter, and you've got to show irreparable injury at F0 and F1, and there seems to me to be a clear distinction here.
Your Honor, I understand that now, yes. And so, under the Eighth Amendment analysis, there's a violation if people are put at a substantial risk of serious harm to their health. So we don't have to show that people at F0 and F1 have been irreparably harmed now. We just have to show that there's a substantial risk that they'll face irreparable harm in the future. And the testimony that was undisputed that risk existed, Dr. Dusnup testified, and this is his hearing testimony at page 58, that treatment, quote, tends to decrease mortality in every stage of hepatitis C, including the F0 and F1 level.
2 minutes, counsel, 2 minutes.
There's a section in the AASLD guidelines, which are in the record at docket entry 142-1-6, entitled Benefits of Treatment for People at Less Than F2. So people at F0 and F1, while they may not be experiencing outward symptoms, first of all, it's not correct to say that they're not being harmed. Their liver is still being scarred. If they're at F1, the functioning of their liver is being impaired, and they're subjected to higher risk of complications, including liver cancer, death, and other serious complications down the road.
Counsel, I understand that. Let me ask you this, my last question in regards to this matter, and I've looked and I couldn't find any cases. Have you, and you may not have looked, did you look to see where outside of a prison situation that when a person goes to the doctor and has been diagnosed at F1 and F4, I mean F0 and F1, that would be malpractice against that doctor if they didn't start treatment immediately with the DAA? Have you looked at that question?
Your Honor, I have not found such a case, but I can tell you from the record that I think it would unquestionably be malpractice. I think even Dr. Dusnup acknowledged that the standard of care was to provide treatment for F0s and F1s, even if...
Do you know of any cases where that has actually been determined that it would be malpractice?
I do not, Your Honor. I don't. I think that given Dr. Dusnup's testimony as to what the standard of care is, and the AASLD guidelines, which are the culmination of some very learned experts in this field showing that the standard of care is to provide treatment at F0 and F1, I think that if somebody a doctor failed to comply with it, that would qualify as malpractice.
If I may, just a follow-up to Judge Baldock's question. But your suggestion is not that a breach of the standard of care, even if we assume that the standard of care is F0 and F1, that a breach of the standard of care alone gives rise to Eighth Amendment deliberate indifference liability, is it? I mean, we've said until we're blue in the face that simple negligence isn't going to get it done.
That's correct, Your Honor. That is not what we're saying. We're saying that...
Time has expired.
If I may answer the question, yes, Your Honor. What we're saying is that negligence and breaching the standard of care is relevant. And when the breach of the standard of care is only for financial reasons to the exclusion of medical judgment, then that is deliberate indifference. Thank you very much, Your Honors. We ask that the district court's order be affirmed.
Thank you.
Should I proceed, Your Honor?
Yes, please.
James Percival for the Florida Department of Corrections. I want to start, if I may, going back to Judge Baldock's question and just reading from the preliminary injunction transcript. This is at page 111, and this is where Dr. Kaziel was asked the question about somebody who doesn't have insurance, and I'm just going to quote it for the court. What she said was, quote, "What I do in that circumstance is I reassure patients, I'm going to follow you carefully. I'm going to try not to let anything happen to you. But I really start to panic, and I really start to scream when it gets to the F3, because that's when people enter the territory. My obligation as a physician is to try to prevent those complications from occurring. And what I want to emphasize is that what she's talking about is the F3. We treat at the F2. So we think, you know, I understand that this testimony is talking about kind of like a particularly bad scenario, but in this testimony, there is a strong flavor of, you know, I can keep an eye on people, and as long as I get them treatment soon enough, they're going to be okay. And what we're saying is the Eighth Amendment, we're proposing doing the same thing, only we're treating more people, and we think the Eighth Amendment is clearly satisfied in that circumstance. I do want to respond to one thing that my opposing counsel said, which is that we did not make the argument we can't afford this. And I want to explain exactly why that's true. So, and the way that they said this in their brief is that we didn't raise a cost defense. So we agree with the plaintiffs that a cost defense is not something we argued and not something we would argue, because a cost defense would be saying we agree that this is falling below minimally adequate care, but we can't afford to pay for it. And we recognize that we can't say that because we recognize that we have to provide minimally adequate care. But the reason we bring up cost is because the district court, in the way it conducted its analysis, faulted us merely because, you know, we were balancing cost and medical concerns. So I just wanted to clarify that. I know I'm running out of time, and we didn't talk about the Prison Litigation Reform Act. I just wanted to touch on that very briefly. One thing is that the plaintiffs, the cases that they rely on, the out-of-circuit case law, and especially the Benjamin D. Frazier case from the Southern District of New York, this case, which plaintiffs cite in support of their position, actually is very critical of this court's precedent, and it refers to Kaysen and those line of cases as, quote, unfortunate appellate rulings, end quote. So we think the fact that plaintiffs are relying on these cases in support of their position actually demonstrates that within the 11th Circuit, reversal is necessary here. The other point I just want to briefly address, I don't think plaintiffs raised this argument, but I thought the court might have questions about it. I want to explain why we think vacature is the appropriate remedy for failure to make the PLRA findings. The first reason is that Johnson v. Breeden, which we cite in our briefing, ordered vacature in this context, and we think that settles it. But there are two reasons why vacature makes sense for failure to make PLRA findings. One is that the statute says, you know, you can't enter an injunction unless you do these things. And the second is that without vacature, it's not clear we would have an appellate mechanism to challenge the district court's findings after it.
Time has expired, counsel.
Thank you. Unless your honors have any questions, we ask the court to reverse.
Thank you. We appreciate the argument.